part of our convention, the last discourse before dinner. And, of course, no introduction necessary for our dear Carl, except one comment that I have to make is that he's an example to the believers, and I'm sure that you all agree with that. Of course, we all are to each other, but Carl being visibly shaken physically, you could see the efforts that it takes to get around and to be a blessing to the dear hearts that are sitting here. So, Carl, the Lord bless you in your ministry, and as you enter into this discourse, and just to give you a little inkling of what this is about, it's on Leviticus 16 chapter, sequences and consequences. Brother Carl.
Well, Brother, we have several preliminary remarks to make. Get those out of the way first. Love and greetings from the Chicago Ecclesia, particularly from my household, my daughters, Sherelle and Joanna, and very especially from Sister Claudia Tosha and Sister Noemi, who have had so little time out the East. They sent their special love. Secondly, I apologize for my present apparel. I did bring a coat, but I left it at the hotel. So I apologize for not fitting these styles custom by having a coat on today. Third, with the very subject matter of Leviticus 16, I think we all recognize that all do not see eye to eye on this chapter, that there are varying opinions as to how this chapter fits into the overall typical framework on the doctrine of salvation. Some see in this strictly pictures of the work of Jesus alone. Others see in this pictures of the cooperative work of Christ and the church. That is not our subject. We're not going to be trying to prove which of these is right or which is wrong. Suffice it to say at this stage that when we look at this, we're looking at an illustration, a type, a picture. And I hope that while there may be disagreement on this picture, that there is a greater sense of agreement on the reality of the grand doctrine behind the picture. And that is the doctrine of salvation. But in the doctrine of salvation, in its simple short terms, we have a concept of redemption and a concept of deliverance. And that redemption is accomplished solely through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ as a ransom for all. But that in the process of deliverance, there's a provision for mankind of 1,000 years educational experience on a highway that leads to holiness. And in that experience, there is a shared work of Jesus and the church as educators, in which the present experiences of the church and the earthly experience of Jesus were the qualifying factors, that which enabled them to be part of the deliverance work of the future. If we suffer with him, then should we reign with him? That concept of deliverance, by some like myself, we like to use the term of the sin offering. Others prefer to use that concept strictly for the work of redemption as opposed to redemption and deliverance. Third preliminary remark we want to make is certain premises that we're going to use in the remarks that we're going to talk about today. I'm working from the premise, because I agree with the premise, that the presentation in Tabernacle Shadows on Leviticus 16 is primarily and fundamentally a correct presentation, that it does cover very much the activities that we would like to speak about. We're not going to argue the premise in our remarks today. Secondly, premise I'm making is that most of you, or all of you, I hope, whether you agree or disagree, have at one time or another read the Tabernacle of Shadows on this chapter, and so I'm not going to lay groundwork regarding what the chapter teaches, but we're going to start from the premise that you know the groundwork, and we're going to look at details in the groundwork, asking questions that are seldom asked about Leviticus 16. Our final preliminary remark is that we'd like to lay down what we consider are some basic rules for the study of pictures, allegories, types, and all of these areas. And there's two basic rules that I think are fundamental in the study of typical pictures. One is that there may be many things that occur in the picture that are not mentioned in the Bible story that are interesting and that may be true and that may even possibly be part of an extended picture, but we have no authority for saying they are. If they're not mentioned in the Bible story itself, then it is pure speculation whether those features also have typical significance. Some of the features in Leviticus 16 this way is whether or not there were Levites in the court on that day. There may or may not have been, but it's not evident in the wording of the picture. Whether or not the priest places hands on the bullock and the Lord's goat, it may be significant, but it's not evident in the phraseology. These are things that become speculation that we're not going to go into in interpretation. Conversely, there may be things that are mentioned in a Bible story that are there to flesh out the story that may or may not be significant. But we think that the scripture rule that would apply there is if we find that they're not significant, the burden of proof lies upon us to show why they're not. That the presumption would be that because they are in the story, they probably are there for a purpose. That they probably have significance. And this goes not only to inclusion of items, but it also goes to the concept of the sequencing of items. And that's what we're going to look at a lot today, is sequencing. There's a sequence of verses. In the handout, that's the main purpose of this handout. 90% of this handout you have in your Bible. 90% of this handout is just a copy of Leviticus 16. The only thing that's different is on the left-hand column, or the second to left, the left-hand column is numbers, but the second column then is what the import of each verse is. And I was surprised this year to find out that the verses are listed in a different order than I expected them to be. They weren't in the order I've always told the story to myself, even though I've always heard the story told. There's sometimes variations in sequence, and some of that we're going to talk about. Our first few questions are very related questions that we're going to look at, and they may seem like dumb questions. The first question is, why is Leviticus 16 the 16th chapter of Leviticus? And it was seen that the obvious answer is, who cares? Or, if that is not the answer, what difference does it make? Or the obvious answer, well, because it follows the 15th. And that's the wrong answer. Leviticus 16:1 reads, "And Aaron spake unto Moses after the death of his two sons," and Aaron spake unto Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, "when they offered before the Lord and died." Now that does not happen in Leviticus 15. That happens back in Leviticus 10. You've got five intervening chapters. I'm glad I got five fingers. You got five intervening chapters there. Sometimes, you know, we don't count, but we others count. Remember those things you just test us in math class? What's the next number in the series? If I say 1 and 2, you say 3. If I say 1 and 3, you say 5. If I say 8 and 9, you say 16. Because that's how we connect those three. We go and we don't follow a logical sequence. Why does 16 come where it does, considering the fact that the verse itself that opens a chapter calls attention back to verse chapter 10. You've got all these chapters in between, and these chapters are totally non-dated chapters. One thing you discover in studying Leviticus is not a historical book. Leviticus is a book of laws, a ritual, a ceremony. And most of Leviticus are regulations that you don't know whether it ever happened or not. That's what should happen. The only parts of Leviticus that are historical are chapters 8 and 9, and a little segment of chapter 24, verses 10 to 23. A funny thing happened to the son of Shelomith, whoever Shelomith was. That's the only historical parts. All of the rest of Leviticus are regulations. We don't have any confirmation, for instance, Leviticus 16, that this happened. We believe it did. But Leviticus 16 tells us what is supposed to happen. on a Day of Atonement. It does not historically say this did happen that day. The consecration of the priesthood, conversely, says, and Moses did. So we know that happened. There we have the sequence. The 10th chapter, well, first let's get an overview of Leviticus. I think that would help us answer this better. Nelson, in his Bible dictionary, makes an interesting observation that we believe to be true. And that is that Leviticus divides into two portions. Chapters 1 to 17 and chapter 18 to the end. The subject matter of 1 to 17 is how do you approach God? And chapters 18 on is having found him, how do you walk with him? Chapters 1 to 17 are justification, purification. Chapters 18 on are sanctification. This is the difference. These are regulations of how to get there. And these are regulations that once you're there, what you do with it. How do you maintain? How do you obtain a relationship? How do you maintain a relationship? That is the overall coverage. Now, focusing down in the first section, chapters 1 through 7 are individual sacrifices. And they can happen anytime. Whenever a circumstance calls for that sacrifice, it happens. A sin offering, an individual peace offering, whatever the offer, there's no dating to it. 8 and 9 are very specific. They happen, I believe it can be shown from the context, once and once only. It was an inauguration not of a priest, but of a priesthood. It was starting the priesthood with the tabernacle arrangement. 10, well, not necessarily positively so. I think there's enough internal evidence that it makes it very reasonable. The 10 is what actually happened on the 8th day, on chapter 9. When they were doing it, there was a flaw that came in, a human flaw, and how this affected chapter 9. It was a historical event that's recorded with great significance. Then he varies. Then he goes off into non-dated items. Chapter 11 deals with purification through food, through diet. What is good to eat, what is not good. Chapter 12 is purification of the mother of a newborn child. What to do over her childhood and how that affected purification. 13 and 14 is the purification of the leper and the cleansing of the leper. 15 is purification over other issues of blood. And then you come to 16. And then you come to 17. So in the first section, in the fall after 16, and that is, when you sacrifice, be sure to do it at the tabernacle. Don't do it anyplace else. And when you got blood involved, don't imbibe any of that personally. That's the life of the animal. That's all 17 says. There's your first half. It's in this half that he puts a parenthesis of 5 chapters. And that's what they are. Chapters 11 through 15 are parenthetical. We know that because chapter 16, 1 says, go back to chapter 10. So I want you to go back there. And now I want to connect a narrative. So the first question is, why separate in the first place? If that's what you want to do, tell us that. Give us these chapters in sequential order. And he says, I'm not telling you that because they are not related time-wise. Chapter 16 does not happen the day, the week, even the month after chapter 9 and 10. In fact, there is a 6-month time delay between chapter 10 and chapter 16. We're going to come into this a little bit more in establishing our relationships, because we're trying to establish this to get a relationship. The relationship he's establishing is not chronological. It says after, but it doesn't say how soon after. It is qualitative. It's a relationship of quality. He's saying, have this Day of Atonement, because this is related to Nadab and Abihu. I want you to keep Nadab and Abihu in mind when you're studying this. There's a connection here. That's what I'm telling you. Otherwise, he wouldn't bother telling us when this happened. He's giving us a reason for this coming in at this stage. Now, two strange things happen in the Nadab and Abihu story. One of them was the audacity, the presumption, the sinfulness of Nadab and Abihu, not so much in offering strange fire. That was certainly the individual cause, but it's larger than that. Their presumption to approach God by their means instead of by God's means. That's the real crime. Just like in the garden, the real crime was not eating a fruit. That was the symptom. The cause was disobedience. Here, the real crime was not offering the strange fire. The crime was presumption that led them to offer this fire. You are presuming that I can be approached. In fact, that brings up a very fundamental question. If you were to finish this sentence, the fewest shortest words, and you can finish it many ways, what would be the best way to finish it? The tabernacle of Israel is. You finish the sentence any way you want to finish it. I suggest that that sentence is best finished with this phrase. The tabernacle of Israel is the earthly house of God. That's the first and primary reason he built it. He said, I will dwell among you. That's what he uses in the New Testament. I will tabernacle among men. His purpose was to be a residence place for the cloud and the Shekinah. I dwell between the cherubim. I also dwell in the cloud. He was there amongst them. I'm glad that clock's in front of me. It's about to get derailed. I won't get derailed. I'll keep more focused to the subject. That is why he immediately, when he says to Moses, now tell Aaron, after Nadab and Abihu, tell him first of all, when he approaches God, don't do it as they did it. Don't do it brashly. Don't do it rashly. And don't do it whenever they want. Do it when I want. I'm there, but visiting hours are once a year. You come on the day that I appoint to come. Verse 2. And the Lord said to Moses, speak unto Aaron thy brother, that he come not at all times into the most holy, is the thought, within the veil, before the mercy seat, which is upon the ark, that he die not, for I will appear in the cloud upon the mercy seat. So his primary function now, he's saying, is I want you to go back to when we consecrated this thing to begin with. When you did that, you didn't keep it clean. You defiled it. You got it dirty. And as a result, we need to clean it up. So he's calling attention not so much at this stage to the sins of the people. They're involved. But that's not the focus point here. The focal point opening the chapter is, I want you to go back to Nadab and Abihu and remember what they did. And don't you do the same thing. I want you now to atone for what happened, starting with that. That's your starting point, and use that as a trigger, a point to go back to. Now, we're going to sort of flash back to this several times, but we'd like to notice the next thing that I not noticed in sequence. Aaron changes clothes on the Day of Atonement. Two times. I never noticed that before. But there's twice when he changes clothes. And he changes clothes a little bit when I didn't expect it. You know, there were five animals involved. Actually, I shouldn't even say that. Let's just go back a little before this. How many animals were offered on the Day of Atonement? The automatic Bible study answer is five. There are five animals offered on the Day of Atonement, according to Leviticus 16. I shouldn't use the word offered, even. Somebody's going to catch me and say, no, the scapegoat wasn't offered, it was let go. But there are five animals involved. And that's not the correct answer. Because in Exodus 29, we got the same sacrifice. He talks about other animals. In Numbers 29, he talks about seven lambs that were given in the morning, and a ram and a bullock for a burnt offering. And then you have the regular lamb in the morning and the evening. You had a lot of animals offered. The five that we're talking about are involved with Leviticus 16 picture, not with the whole Day of Atonement. The Jewish tradition is that the function of the high priest throughout the year was supervisory. And therefore, the high priest always wore his garments of glory and beauty. And that appears to be fairly well established in Scripture, that that was his usual apparel, was the garments of glory and beauty. He said, you should wear these forever, continually. These words seem to indicate he had them on regularly. However, part of the Jewish tradition is that while Aaron was supervising the other days of the year, Aaron did all the sacrificing on the Day of Atonement. And I think that is evidently not true. Aaron did the sacrificing of the animals involved in Leviticus 16. He did not do the sacrificing of the animals of the morning and evening sacrifice of the other lambs, Numbers 29, the other animals. He's involved here, and that is shown by the change of clothes. So let's focus. We got five animals involved in this picture. You've got a bullock for a sin offering, and its ram for a burnt offering, taken from the flocks of Aaron. You've got, to quote the verse exactly, two goats for a sin offering and their burnt offering. These are the five animals that are involved. Now, I had always pictured that, okay, he takes his animals, he brings them into the court, and he gets busy. But that's not the sequence given in Leviticus 16. Let's read on. In verse 3, he takes two of the animals only, not all five. Then shall Aaron come into the holy place, here the court, with a young bullock for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen coat. He shall have the linen breeches upon his flesh. He shall be girded with a linen girdle, and with a linen mitre shall he be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore shall wash his flesh in water and put them on. And, obvious thought is, sequentially, next, he shall take of the congregation of Israel, they're outside the court, that's where they are, he takes two kids for a goat of a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. Notice he has different clothes when he takes different animals. He's still wearing the glory robes, his usual garment, when he brings the bullock and its ram into the court. Then he changes clothes. Then he goes out and gets the other animals and brings them in. It's an unusual sequence, but that's a sequence that is mentioned. As we said in our preliminary remarks, maybe that sequence is not necessarily true. But we're going to assume that it is, because it's our burden to show that there's a reason for it not being true, if it's not. So we assume that that is the sequence that's there. What then is shown by bringing the bullock and its ram in before he changes into the sacrificial robes? And we think it's a beautiful picture. When Christ left the heavenly glory, usually we think of the glory robes, and that is a basic picture representing not the glory of nature, but the glory of office down at the far end of the age. But I think he's using it in an accommodated sense here. Then at the beginning, he says, he left the spirit nature. He divested himself. But before he did that, he had to make a certain arrangement. And that arrangement was that he was to be born in the court. Not be born outside like you and I are. He had to maintain that perfection. He speaks of this in Hebrews, Paul does, saying, a body has not prepared him. There's a special preparation for his body. And that, we think, is shown by while he's still in the garments of glory and beauty, before he's born on the earth, he arranges for him to be in the court condition. The arrangements are made for how this transfer of nature is to be made, so he doesn't end up out there. He ends up where he belongs. But he finds you and me out there. And he comes to us in a sacrificial robes. So there's a logic to his sequence. There's a logic to having the change afterwards. Now, you may have noticed, in looking carefully at this verse of clothes, some of these clothes are not changed. Some of these clothes he wore both before and after, and other clothes are changed. Let's read it very carefully. Verse 4. He shall put on the linen coat. That seeming is something he didn't have on before. That's a new piece of armor. He shall have the linen breeches upon his flesh. He had them on already. It was the same undergarments that were worn. These are not part of the overall picture. They're just white linen. They're just a functional use. He's just showing that he had those already on. He shall be girded with a linen girdle. That's a new piece. He shall be this. He didn't have that before. And with the linen mitre shall he be attired. But now the linen mitre is involved with glory robes as well. In fact, there is a scripture that says that golden crown, holiness of the Lord, that he wore that all the time. At all times, even when sacrificing, that mitre was always there. So this, we believe, was the same mitre that he came in. That was not involved in the change. What really is involved is the outer robe. Did you notice what's missing? And it's missing also in the garments of glory and beauty. There's one piece of garment that you and I feel we must wear, that it never speaks of the high priest or the under priest wearing. No shoes. There are no shoes mentioned. He doesn't have shoes in the garments of glory and beauty. He doesn't have shoes here. And it's obvious he shouldn't have. Remember what God told Moses earlier in the burning bush. Take off your shoes. This is holy ground. The tabernacle was consecrated ground. It was holy ground. No shoes are mentioned. You could almost say that this is one case, even though the floor was dirt, sand, he wouldn't get his feet dirty. He wouldn't defile his feet by walking barefoot. But his feet would defile the floor. His walk could defile the tabernacle, and that's why you have the Day of Atonement. But you don't have the concept of the shoes that are mentioned here. That is one thing that's by omission, and you notice it as you look carefully at the clothes that are worn. Now he changes clothes later in the day, back to garments of glory and beauty. You can challenge me on this because it doesn't say that. But let me read the verse, turn your sheet over, and we have to go down to verse 23. And we want to, again, we're going to read it just the way it's put. And Aaron shall come into the tabernacle of the congregation and put off the linen garments which he shall put on, which he put on when he went into the holy place, and leave them there. And he shall wash his flesh with water in the holy place, and put on his garments, and come forth and offer his burnt offering, and so on. It does not say he shall put off his linen garments and put on glory and beauty. It says he shall put off his garments and put on his garments. But we think it does mean exactly what we've always thought, that it does mean the garments of glory and beauty. You do have three options. You could say he took off his linen garments, washed himself, put them back on. And you could partially defend that, but weakly. You could say he took off his dirty linen garments, washed himself, and put on clean linen garments. There'd be no reason not to say that. The scripture doesn't confine you. But you could say with equal ease, he put off his linen garments and put on his usual garments. And interestingly enough, many translations say that, his usual garments. And while it's not a translation but an interpretation, we think it's a correct interpretation, that he does put on the garments of glory and beauty. This is showing a change of the nature back to not Jesus' spirit being, but to the Christ office of the high priest. It's picturing the entire office. But now notice the sequence. Having done that, now he offers a burnt offering, the latter part of verse 24. And now, after he's changed the garments in glory and beauty, the fat of the sin offering shall be burnt upon the altar. And now, after he's changed the garment in glory and beauty, he that let go the goat for the scapegoat shall wash his clothes and bathe his flesh in water, and afterward come to the camp. And now, after he's in garments of glory and beauty, and the bullock for the sin offering and the goat for the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall one carry without the camp, and they shall burn the fire their skins and their flesh and their dung. And now he that burneth them shall wash his clothes and bathe his flesh in water, and afterwards he shall come in the camp. The sequence given in Leviticus, if that sequence is correct, is he changes clothes, offers the burnt offering, offers the fat of the sin offering upon the burnt offering. The person who lets the scapegoat go washes his clothes. He offers the fire outside the camp. The person who did that washes his clothes. And now he's finished that part of the day. That's the order given. It's not the order we usually think of the events. We usually think and talk about three tabernacle fires. One in the holy, one in the court, one outside the camp, as being three simultaneous experiences. Three viewpoints by different groups simultaneously. And that probably is not totally incorrect. After all, those fires burn for a while. And so that the fire in the holy may still be burning when they did these two fires. But they are burned after the burnt offering. They are burned after the change in garments. So now we're left with the question, why? Since these picture, obviously by Hebrews, experiences relating to the earth. He went without the camp, bearing his reproach. It shows an earthly experience. Why does he put the sequence as he puts it? And I think there's a simple answer to this. A suggestive answer. There may be other answers, and I may be corrected. I'll be glad to be corrected. But this is how it appears to me, the simple answer to defend the sequence. One of the questions that's often discussed regarding the Day of Atonement is the Day of Atonement for the sins of the past year or the future year? And I think that in the discussion, the obvious answer is missed. Some say past, some say future, and the obvious answer is yes. It is for the experiences of the past year and the future year, in different ways. In different ways. The altar had gotten dirty during the past year. It had been defiled. It needs to be cleansed. That's past. That's got to be taken care of. But it's got to be cleansed so that it will be clean for the experience of the future year, so that it can be acceptance for the future year. So its function, it looks forward by treating that which is backwards. It's got two directions. It looks simultaneously. And I would suggest that that's what's shown here. That what he's showing is a sequence that Aaron does in certain garment, sacrificial robes. And he says, now that sequence relates to that which is past. Then there's a sequence that relates to the garments of glory and beauty. He said, now that sequence of this day relates to the future. But here is your dividing point. You're looking two ways. You're looking two directions. And really, I think that's what the New Testament teaches on salvation. What cleanses sin? One thing only, the blood of Christ. That is the only soul-cleansing power for sin. Now, it's sprinkled twice, and that shows that it is applied on two different occasions. Once for the bullock, once for the goat. But it still represents the same blood. It's the blood of Christ. That is the only thing that offsets justice in the Most Holy. That looks backward. That looks back to all the sins that have happened. It says these need to be wiped clean. We need a clean slate to start from. He does that in the sacrificial robes. He looks backward. He said that was there. But there's another aspect. And that aspect is why he was in the process of doing this. He was having new experiences. Experiences of a human being. Experiences of feeling persecuted. Being persecuted, not feeling it. Experiences of identifying with man and what he is. Experiences in trials and testings. And those experiences are pictured by that fire outside the camp. He's bearing his reproach out there. And those experiences are not applied until man is raised. They are looking future. They are looking forward to the corrective experiences. So it looks both ways. It shows that sharp division between the two works that are there. One looking in this direction, in the garments of sacrifice, and the other looking in that direction, in the garments of glory and beauty. That was a related seldom asked question. And that question is, why is the Day of Atonement the 10th day of the 7th month? Why is it the 9th day or the 12th day or the 3rd day of the 4th month or any other day? And of course, again, there's an obvious answer, because God said so. And that's the bottom line answer you can't deny. But why did God say so? What is his reason behind this? We'd like to suggest something here. Give you a little math problem where we're doing it. Try our mathematic heads out. We'll try to go slowly. It's simple math. It's just addition and subtraction. The feast days of Israel are mentioned in 3 chapters in the Bible. They are mentioned in Exodus 34, Leviticus 23, and Numbers 29. But in Exodus 34, there's an exception. Exodus 34 differs from the other two chapters in that it does not mention the Day of Atonement. It's mentioned in the other two lists. And the other two lists are chronological lists. They start with the first month, Feast of Passover, and they go down to the Feast of Weeks, and they go down to the first day of the 7th month, the Feast of the New Year, to the 10th day, the Feast of the Day of Atonement, to the Feast of Tabernacles. But it's missing in Exodus. The date was not set in Exodus. The date is set later. Exodus there is historical. Where Leviticus is very little history, Exodus is 90% history. Exodus is a historical book. Numbers is a combination of both. So at that time, it isn't listed. Let's follow Moses at that time. Moses comes to Mount Sinai with all the people of Israel. And here is this 80-year-old man climbing Mount Sinai, not once, but 6 times in a short period of time. He goes up, down. He's a human escalator. He goes up and down the mount over and over again. And he did pretty short order. This took time to do this. So let's look a little bit at the time involved and try to date 2 things. On a yearly calendar, we want to date the consecration of the priesthood, of Exodus 9. We want to date the Day of Atonement. Not from the internal evidence of the verse itself, but from the external evidence of the background. It says in Exodus 19 that they arrived at Mount Sinai in the 3rd month. The rabbis assume that it was the first day of the 3rd month. And their general assumption is that the law was given on the day of Pentecost, the 50th day. And it's not an illogical assumption. I think it's probably a correct assumption. Okay, now, with that in mind, let's start our mathematics. The Day of Atonement is the 10th day of the 7th month. That's 6 full months and 10 days. 6 times 30 is 180. It's 190 days into a year. All we're going to do is subtract 190 and find out where we are. On the Day of Pentecost, they're at Sinai, just beginning their experiences there. Day of Pentecost is 50 days after the 16th of Nisan. So it's the 6th day of the 3rd month. That's 66 days. So we had, over here, I had a column, 66 days. Okay, we got 66 days. Now he ascends the mountain 6 times. Twice he stays 40 days. Each time the 40 days stays, he brings back tables of law. Tables he broke and the other tables. So he got 66 plus 80, 146. You've got, on one of the occasions, he goes up and he stays 7 days. That's in the record. So that's 153 out of that. Other times we don't know. One appears to be only 1 day. Goes up and comes back the same day. The others, we're not too sure of the duration. One of the times he comes down, he stays for a considerable time before going back up. He moves his tent, which was then called the tabernacle, to a special spot, and they dwell for a while. We don't know how long that dwelling was. But we've already got 66 plus 80, 146, plus 7, 153, plus the 1 day stay, 155. If that was in the area of a month, which would be very logical, that story that's told there, it's 3 whole chapters that take place during that. you've got about 185 days. It would seem that they began construction of the tabernacle about 1 year, if not exactly 1 year, before the Day of Atonement. So what more logical time than the time to look backward and say, this is going to be a yearly sacrifice. We've been here a year now. We're having our first one, and every year we're going to do this. We're going to cleanse it. That it was, that day may very well have been picked. But there's also an interrelationship that is interesting. The Day of Atonement is related to the Feast of Tabernacles in the same way that the selection of the Paschal Lamb is related to the Feast of Passover. It's the identification of the lamb to be offered in both cases. One is in the first month, one is in the seventh, 6 months apart. The selection of Paschal Lamb was on the 10th day of the first month. The 10th day of the seventh month is the relationship, precisely. The feast in both cases starts at the 15th, in both cases. So I see the parallelism that's there. Well, I was usually beginning about halfway to what we expected, but let's go into one more question. And Leviticus, the 16th chapter and the 18th verse. And he shall go unto the altars before the Lord and make an atonement for it, and shall take of the blood of the bullock and the blood of the goat and put it upon the horns of the altar round about. Here is a primary focal point in the chapter. So much of the chapter has to deal with this incident as being the objective of the day. His object was to cleanse the tabernacle for his future year. And so this becomes a very centralized objective. You could say the objective was to sprinkle the blood, but that was to sprinkle the blood so he could do this. This was the ultimate use, utilization to cleanse this. And he cleanses the whole, he says he cleanses the whole building, but only mentions sprinkling blood one place, upon the altar. What altar? We would think, probably, as I would think, that the brazen altar. This is the altar where sacrifices were offered. But Exodus says no. Exodus very specifically states in the 30th chapter of the 10th verse that it was the golden altar upon which was to sprinkle the blood on the Day of Atonement. This is the altar, the cleansing of which cleanses the whole. It's this altar that becomes the center of attention for the purification of the entire. Because it's this altar that was essential for the subject matter of the approach to God. The high priest could not get into that beyond the veil, even the first time, unless the incense was there. Now, what is that incense? And we've got two answers to that question. And they're both right and they're both wrong. One answer is based on Psalm 144, where there's a very specific statement as to what the incense is. Psalm 141, excuse me. Psalm 141, verse 2. Let my prayer be set before thee as incense, and the lifting of my hands as the evening sacrifice. That verse says prayer is incense. Now let's look at Revelation 8th chapter. That doesn't say that. Revelation 8 says something a little different. Revelation chapter 8. Verse 3 and 4. And another angel came and stood at the altar having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which is before the Lord. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended before God. Now one says incense is the prayers, and the other says the incense is the accompaniment to prayers. And the easy harmony is there are two different incense offerings at different times. Psalm 141 is not talking Day of Atonement. It has no relation to Day of Atonement. He mentions what it relates to. Let my prayer be set before thee as incense, and the lifting of my hands as the evening sacrifice. He's talking the daily offering of incense, morning and evening, happen every day of the year. He says that incense represents prayers. Revelation is talking about a parallelism to the Day of Atonement. He's not talking the Day of Atonement per se, but he's got parallel illustrations. He said that incense is offered as an accompaniment because that incense was offered only with the bullock. It represents the perfections of Christ in whose name we pray. And so that accompanies our prayers to be acceptable. Whereas the daily sacrifice represents our prayers themselves, which are also now acceptable and sweet-smelling in the virgin. We'll stop. Our chairman's here.
It's tough to stop when you're on a roll, right, Carl? Well, all I can say, brethren, is that we have a blessing that we have tape recorders. Because I'm going to have to listen to that again. And, of course, you know, a lot of these beautiful pictures apply to ourselves. And they are the deep things of God. And they should...